I don't want to talk about what's dead and what's dying, but I want to talk about the lesson of Appalachia for the rest of this country. Because the interrelationship, the connections that Norris talked about between the profit motive, the nature of politics, and the problems of pollution are so very clear in Appalachia. People came down, made their money, ruined the land, ruined the people, and went off to exploit others elsewhere. The people, the land remained behind, suffered, crippled. So that this is pollution, and this is something that, as our speakers have told us, is now happening across America. We don't know when Lake Erie died, it just happened. But it happened because the U.S. Steel Company pours tons and tons and tons of waste into the lake, into all the Great Lakes are being destroyed. The biologists tell us that the oceans will die if present trends continue. Norris has talked about Alaska. The world is being destroyed by men's greed. A man named Marshall Goldman, an economist, he teaches at Wellesley University, writes in his book, Controlling Pollution, The Economics of a Cleaner America. It's a Prentice Hall book for $1.95 if people want to pick it up. It's worth looking at. Generally, the fines are so low, the laws so poorly enforced, and the cost of pollution control so high that polluters frequently prefer to continue their past violations because the cost of polluting is minimal. If you pollute, you make money. If you don't pollute, you lose profits. This is the single most important thing that one has to know about pollution, that the private cost to the polluter is small, but the social cost to the society is very great.
Hello, Radioland. You're listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. This is another episode of Darshiv. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. This is the radio program where we talk about archives, we talk about resources that we have access to at the Yukon Library. And today, I'm joined with an intern that I've been working with for the last semester, Adriana Chestnut, who is a UConn senior this year, political science and human rights double major. And currently, she's been interning at the Archives and Special Collections and working on issues around environmental activism, student activism specifically. And so I invited Adriana in today to talk a little bit about her research and the work that she's been doing around the global climate strike. Adriana, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So that first clip, I was wondering if you could kind of unpack that a little bit for us. I know it kind of sounded a little out of context, but it's a pretty strong, pithy quote. Mm-hmm. Where did you get that, and what about that resonated with you?
Yeah, so that was a clip from the 1970s Earth Day, well, the original Earth Day on campus in 1970. And I kind of chose it because it showed a lot of the dialogue and narrative surrounding issues with ecology for the time. Specifically, a lot of it was pollution. A lot of what I found were people talking about pollution and, corruption with the institution, corruption with big business, corruption and all that kind of, just that sort of narrative was a lot of what I found throughout what I was looking through in the archives, and so I thought it tied in very well.
Sure. I found it interesting that he mentions Appalachia because I feel like that location, anyway, as far as, you know, most of the student left was concerned, this was always like a very referent location in mm-hmm. the United States. I think it definitely was as far as, you know, Southern voting, kind of just thinking about who was getting left out of the narrative, the national conversation. It was usually the sort of miner's daughter narrative. So Appalachia seems to, you know, it still is an issue that we talk about as far as like leveling mountaintops right. and strip mining and that kind of thing. But it's always fascinating to me to see Appalachia kind of get drawn out like that. So as a historical resource, you know, you were interested specifically in environmental activism, when this began, and kind of its comparatives to today. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, what about that topic interested you, and what sort of archives did you end up consulting and finding relating to this issue?
Well, the topic of environmentalism became very important to me this past semester, especially considering what has been going on the past couple of months on campus. So I became involved with the group Fridays for Future on campus following the climate strike on September 20th. And so just getting involved with Fridays for Future and a more leftist environmental movement on campus sort of got me very intrigued and interested in what students were doing in the past and how this first became a part of just the history of UConn to begin with. And because we have so many environmental focused, sustainability focused groups on campus already, but they kind of work within the university and they kind of feel like commonplace and just something that we gloss over, something that we see because we're so used to having them around. It feels very normal and common that we have groups like Eco Husky, the Office of Sustainability, everything like that. So I was really interested into seeing how this sort of started. And the real catalyst was that 1970 Earth Day on April 22nd, 1970, obviously.
And just for folks who don't know, I guess, exactly what has been going on here on campus or other campuses across the country and the world, actually, the global climate strike, could you talk a little bit about kind of the global climate strike, call to action, Greta Thunberg, just kind of the current issue right now that you and your fellow students have been taking up?
Yeah, absolutely. So Fridays for Future was started on campus this past semester by a group of people inspired by Greta Thunberg and her global movement, Fridays for Future. And it really started on campus, building up to the September 20th global climate strike. And there we sort of branched off and had this group of seven or so demands for UConn, for the university, in its complacency with the climate emergency happening right now on campus. And so we've been working every single Friday, demonstrating as a result of this original climate strike, just trying to pressure the university into, you know, taking action and taking responsibility for its role in climate change, basically.
And I think what's great about it that really compares to student generations of the past is that Fridays for Future takes place in Gully Hall. So it's kind of an active sit-in as well as organizing tactic for the group itself. And Gully Hall, for those of you who are UConn alum, know it as where the president's office is. Many other political movements, anti-Vietnam War, racism, women's movement, a lot of these groups throughout the last 50 years have gone to Gully Hall to do a similar sort of action. So there's a historical kind of precedent to occupying that space for the demands that students are kind of putting on the university and its administration currently. Was I correct that you have a quote from a previous student that kind of gives us a bit of context also about a perspective from an earlier period?
Yeah. So this is a quote from Janet Rogers, and she was involved with the Ecology Club in coordinating the first Earth Day at UConn. And she says, "Past midnight, two stealthy Yukon women slipped into the cold water of Mira Lake. In darkness on the island, we hung our sign of black paint on white sheets to welcome Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. As day dawned, millions of Americans came together to ask questions, raise awareness, and generate action for better stewardship of our one and only spaceship Earth. The groundswell of the environmental movement exploded into a network of connectivity for positive change and how to live more wisely as part of our Mother Earth.
So what about that quote, I guess, feels similar or feels like a very distant idea? What did you kind of find, I guess, in your research about that initial movement around Earth Day to what students are talking about today?
It just seemed very apparent that students on UConn campus have constantly been inspired by the global movements that are happening or the national movements that are happening, especially surrounding issues of the environment, particularly.
So in addition to kind of the global movement, you know, it sounds like Janet is describing what is an act of civil disobedience. For those who don't know, it is also against the rules, the school rules, to swim in Mirror Lake. So what about that kind of action resonates with you? Is that something that you think students today would consider as a form of political activism, or is that kind of, you know, that just doesn't really fit into the organizing that you guys are involved in?
Well, the swimming across Mirror Lake specifically, I mean, you have random students doing that all the time now, seeing whether or not they get caught. But I think that, you know, the point of that stand is that we today are also organizing outside of the rules of the university or trying to push the university to act more responsibly in terms of the environment from this outside perspective rather than working within. It's really that sort of pressure from the outside and not following the rules, not following their guidelines on how we're going to do things, but rather setting our own goals, setting our own demonstrations, really trying to rally other students around this issue without, you know, putting it past them whether or not, oh, is this okay that we do this? Is this okay? Do we, you know, asking permission, you know, obviously the president doesn't like it sitting inside of his office every week. It's not exactly something that the university loves from us. But really just they're minor acts of civil disobedience that we are trying to continue today so as to not harm anyone in our group. Obviously, if we do anything too major, at this point, but yeah, we really want to catch the attention of the university, and maybe in 1970 that was swimming in Mirror Lake and holding up a big sign, and today it's, you know, where we sit on the seal, play music, hand out pamphlets to people, or hold speakers and rally and walk to Gully Hall and just get people to sit inside until our demands are met.
Right. And it seems like equal measures to grab attention or try and get focus from other students who maybe haven't really thought much about this topic and potentially can kind of recognize their impact on the rest of the environment around them, specifically locally here at the University of Connecticut. So in terms of the archival work that you did, what kind of sources did you find and what kind of media, I guess, were people using to talk about this?
Well, a lot of what I found was either put out in the UConn Free Press or at the time, the Connecticut Daily Campus. It was basically just little pockets of information that I would find on what was going on. Not necessarily a strong narrative, but maybe a map of that original Earth Day. And then in sources like the Inner Tooth, what students continued to do past this strict 1970 point, maybe throughout like 1974, you know, their goals and things like recycling was a big thing that students were pushing on campus. Or just general issues pertaining to ecology and instituting education in ecology and environmental matters was a big deal. But yeah, I found primarily student created media, student-created publications that kind of gave me a small but interesting narrative on what they were trying to do.
And just as a caveat, you know, of course, that doesn't mean that there wasn't activity happening in ways that right. was not documented or accounted for in your research project, let alone in the archives. But again, that is one element of like making sure that student groups kind of return to the historical by thinking through, well, the work that you're doing today can then inform students going forward in the future. So, yeah, I always have to toot my horn about like the documentation. Like, sadly, if it doesn't get recorded in a big way in the future, it may appear that it did not happen.
Yeah.
Which is difficult.
Right.
Was there any kind of overlap you found regarding agriculture? You know, here's the university, which is a land grant school. It's initially an ag school, you know, moves out of that sphere sometime in the early half of the 20th century. But was there any element around what environmental activism or environmentalism looks like from a sort of farming perspective?
Not really. That was sort of more something that emerged in the materials that I found within the last 15 years or so, is, you know, our connection to the local farms and, you know, student-run farms and things like that. But as for that sort of 1970s era, like early to mid 1970s era, all I really found was information on food co-op and how people are not using the food co-op like they should be. But yeah, it feels like a more recent institution really within the university. From what is available research-wise.
It's always fascinating, too, to think about what are the political issues of environmental awareness that gets folks thinking. You know, like recycling, I feel like to us is kind of this very, you know, yes, mm-hmm. we are recycling, you know, like, mm-hmm. But of course, that was not, and I mean, even still today in a lot of sections of the United States, when recycling is like dismissed as a non-effective, you know, waste of taxpayer dollars and these kinds of things, there are definitely those elements of argument and reaction. But it's kind of these like societal actions that implicate people in amongst mm-hmm. themselves. And from that standpoint, I guess, what were those big issues for them in the initial Earth Day? Like what was the action that they wanted people to take? Was it like not littering? Like, was it something as basic as that?
I think it was more just awareness based. They really wanted to educate people and they wanted to tell people that these are issues. A lot of it was, again, pollution based. There were week-long activities in that, in the span of that original Earth Day show, it was like a whole week of activities leading up to this kind of group of speeches. But there were many things that they tried to do. There were anti-pollution activities. There were, you know, lectures and demonstrations on campus. I think in Wilbur Cross Library at the time, they wanted to have a pollution room filled with foul odors for people to walk through. Yeah, but a lot of it was very pollution-based and the awareness of who, you know, who is the main polluter and what is the issue here.
Who did they call out about that? Were they kind of laying focus on the administration of a university, or was it more like we are consumers, polluters, et cetera?
Right. Nothing was really against the university. If anything, it was just to call attention to the university that these are issues that happened. But it was a more, you know, calling attention to pollution on a global standpoint, that like big companies pollute. And, you know, we really just got to be aware of what's happening here and be more mindful as consumers in this kind of world.
And I guess further to that end, did you find any kind of historical record about the shifts in administrative policy regarding, you know, student demands about pollution to, you know, the creation of the sustainability committee, you know, to sort of fulfill XYZ mandate that the administration has sort of had to put on itself?
Unfortunately, I didn't find a lot of information on that kind of stuff. What I really found was with this issue of recycling, glass recycling by like 1972 was very experimental, and a lot of how it got instituted within the university was very student run, and it was, you know, on the backs of the students to make sure this was implemented and instituted and continued with full force. But with a lack of interest, everything eventually kind of fell apart, so to speak. And then when we start to see everything right now that's commonplace, you know, by 2019 and everything that's happened within the last 15 years, it feels very administrative. It feels like a lot of the sustainability changes that are happening on campus really do come from like state mandates, and offices around campus were being incentivized to go green. Yeah, we had sort of a good green standpoint at a green ranking, like the Sierra Club, Cool Schools and everything. And once we sort of had that ranking, we kind of wanted to keep doing everything in our power as a school to show that, like, oh yeah, like, we go green, we do this, XYZ. I think there was one Earth Day in 2007 that we had that showed tours of like the LEED certified buildings on campus and things like that. But a lot of that and why we had LEED certified buildings on campus do come from like these incentives and mandates from the state, you know.
Which I think are, you know, it demonstrates kind of the, I guess, the natural progression that the state and a capitalist economy have in relationship with each other. You know, like, here is kind of one mode that consumers can kind of pat themselves on the back about. Of course, there's that if you're looking at it from a pessimistic view. But also then the other angle of, like, you know, a university wants to appeal to students like yourself to, you know, bring in kind of that aesthetic or that sort of that thing that they can claim, right? And I know similarly from a human rights background, you know, PETA would give them sort of like a rating similarly that they had always achieved in the last 15 years, like a very top rating about options for vegetarians and vegans, which is all tied into this environmental conversation as well. And like, you want that, right? Like, you can also serve veal, but you can then also serve like vegan food and like bring in all of the different kinds of students and their interests. So I guess, do you see that as being in any way, I guess, part of the role that a university can take to bringing in students who might then help push that needle further down the marker? You know, if they're able to kind of say, well, you know, our school has these baselines, Sierra Club, from PETA, whoever it might be, can it work in a way that's going to ultimately kind of start to drive some change that may have a lasting impact?
I think that sounds very nice. I think it would be great if that was UConn's overall goal with a lot of these shifts that they're doing. I know we had a big issue recently. I know Fridays for Future took a big issue recently with the solar panels on top of Worth Tower and how that was a big selling point for students to come here. The university really pushed that and be like, we're very green, we have solar powers for this entire building. But there was very little information on the kind of power that was actually generating or whether or not it was working or, you know, things like that. So I think that the university wants to be as green as it can be without sort of losing its investments with a lot of different, you know, industries. So to say that they want to bring people in that push them further, I'm not entirely sure that that is their goal. But hopefully we can kind of flip that and make that the goal of new students coming in.
I think that's a good, that's a good mandate to put on the list. Okay, so in terms of the administration, you know, you'd mentioned some of the contemporary issues about sort of who on the board, XYZ corporate, you know, sort of involvement mm-hmm. that is ultimately the sort of the sunk investment to the university. You know, that is not a dissimilar story to the period that the students in 1970 were talking about as far as who was involved in weapons manufacture mm-hmm. during the war in Vietnam. That quote that you read from earlier from Janet Rogers, that was from an exhibition that we'd hosted at the Archives and Special Collections this fall 2019 around student activism on campus. You know, women highlighted sort of their position as women on campus, anti-draft, students of color, black students specifically, in a lot of ways about how they found themselves in the student body. So one other clip that I want to play that you had selected from the Earth Day reading 1970 speeches is on very much this issue of race, and mm-hmm. I'd like to get your perspective on it after we play it.
You know, like, we talk about air pollution. We talk about water pollution and the problems facing America. And like Rich referred to Dick Gregory, and he said the number one problem facing America is moral pollution. You know, how can you relate to air pollution and water pollution when people are starving? You know, how can you relate to air pollution and water pollution when you got ghettos and things that are infested with rats and roaches? You know, we're talking about survival. We can't deal with abstract terms. Let's talk about that air and water pollution. Why all of a sudden is just beginning to come up? You know, we always had the problem that of environmental conditions, and now all of a sudden we just all rallying between air and water pollution. Why all of a sudden right now we are doing it? Let's check it out. Let's check it out. The president of this country and the State of the Union address, the Union address that supposed to set the priorities for the country of that year, to decide what things are going to be governed on, to decide what things that they're going to work on. And the only thing he talked about was air and water pollution, and everybody cheered and everything. So that's what we supposed to be working on. But no black people cheered, because we know that's not the problem. You can solve all your air and water pollution tomorrow, and you still got oppression and racism in this country. You know, you're going to have to deal. Black people and other minority groups in this country feel that unless you deal with these other problems in air and water pollution, we all deserve to die. Because there's other issues that are too close to our minds.
So that was, again, a reading from the initial Earth Day, like the clip we began with. Can you talk a little bit about that, Adriana? Just kind of where that comes from, I guess. How does that situate in terms of the issues that you guys are facing today as a student group? Yeah. And, just kind of what are those comments? How do they help us?
Right. This clip comes from, again, those Earth Day speeches. It comes from the perspective of a black student who took the stage to talk. And what was very interesting was that this Earth Day happened roughly 2 days after a racist incident in Sousa housing while two black students were announcing a rally for Bobby Seale's Day. And so while these Earth Day speeches were going on, black students were at Gully Hall dealing with these issues of racism they were facing with the university, going up against the university. while it's safe to say predominantly white students were at the Earth Day, they were talking about these issues of environmentalism without showing any sort of support or solidarity for the Black students on campus. And I think that really reflects what's happening today. I think this semester in particular, with the, you know, incident at Charter Oak Housing, and the issues that the Black students today are raising with the university. You know, we had the march, the anti-racism march and rally a couple of weeks ago, I think the end of October. Yeah, I think it just goes to show that we are talking about the same exact issues today that we were literally almost 50 years ago. The same things are still happening on UConn campus. We still have our environmental issues. We still have issues of racism, and they're overlapping.
Yeah, I think it's not atypical that those are still issues that students like yourself, as well as just like folks who live in our society generally, still have to kind of navigate.
Right.
Because these are big issues. I think what's interesting about it too is the, you know, in this way, in this clip, he is framing it in a way that says, like, if we're not dealing with this issue, then we can't afford to deal with the other. And, you know, which is a very real lived experience that, like, comes from a very genuine place, especially at that exact moment, as you identified, you know, that there had been an issue around racist harassment on campus in 1970, and the incident that you'd referred to that happened this fall on this campus was white students overheard using anti-Black racist slander, basically, outside of a residence hall. And, you know, students again had to kind of come out and demand that they deserve respect and, you know, sort of a general understanding and precedent setting. And so, you know, these kind of issues have sort of been brought up as divisive. How, I guess, do you see the current movement being able to tackle that issue? How has the ecology movement evolved, clearly with the awareness that, like, you know, we are all affected by ecology movement, environmental degradation. However, white people are not the targets of racism in the same way that Black people are.
Right. I think the dialogue that we are really trying to put out there and act upon today is that of climate justice and addressing issues of environmental racism, and also just acting in solidarity in general with these other movements on campus. About 2 weeks ago, we had a big rally, our March of Solidarity, between our chapter of Fridays for Future, Revolution Against Rape, as well as the UConn chapter of the NAACP and the UConn Coalition for Collaborative Organizing. We basically there just showed how all of our issues are combined, how they overlap, how, you know, justice for one of us can't happen without justice for all of us. We need to be in support of each other, because it is the sad reality that the university does not always protect, you know, the oppressed people on its campus. Despite creating these spaces for them, we are still struggling.
So having said that, also, you know, I guess the one through thread that I think kind of ties a lot of this together is the sort of global justice element, you know, seeking justice for what are largely the populations that are way more vulnerable to these issues that have been flagged as like white middle class concerns and liberal concerns, but actually, you know, ultimately will affect those populations of color who are not white middle class.
Right.
And I feel like that is kind of that's a dovetail, right, for this whole movement.
A lot of the speeches that we heard 2 weeks ago again, they really incorporated the issue of how, you know, our investment in things like the fossil fuel industry is directly contributing to these different like power plants and just horrible things that are reducing the health of poor communities of color, especially within Connecticut. There were people talking about, you know, asthma in these communities as well, and how we are really just, how environmentalism, how, you know, our commitment, I guess, as a university to the continual use of fossil fuels is really harming people, really harming poor communities of color within our state directly right now. And not only that, but really across the board.
So as a sort of takeaway from this sort of historical approach to the history of student activism kind of beginning more or less, I think you'd say, in this 1970 Earth Day mm-hmm. movement, which didn't sound like an easy kumbaya that maybe some had hoped to organize. Mm-hmm. Clearly there were some dissenting voices around like what Earth Day should be.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, what can we learn from this? And what is it that you think will kind of propel your student movement to kind of overcome some of these challenges that the 1970 Earth Day movement had?
I think the biggest, you know, I think solidarity is just probably the most important thing that we can have as any sort of student movement on campus. You know, there really was no great show of solidarity here in 1970 at that Earth Day. Obviously, the Black students didn't care about the original Earth Day because none of the other students actually came out in support of them. None of the other students, you know, cared about the racism that was happening on campus, that was continually happening on campus during this time period. So I think today, our shows of solidarity, our acts of solidarity, and continuing to work with these groups on campus, it not only makes us stronger from a just social activist point of view, you know, having more numbers, having more voices, having more people to really come out and demand, or having more people to advocate on behalf of our demands, but also I think that when we act in solidarity, we also show how these issues affect one another, how everybody is affected by issues of climate change. And I think that's really what we're trying to put out more than anything else. I think that Fridays for Future is really committed to this narrative of climate justice and how, you know, poor people of color are the most affected by issues of environmental destruction, and how their voices are some of the most important in the current day and age in this current fight for climate justice, you know. And yeah, I just think solidarity and amplifying those voices is probably the most important thing we can do right now.
So that seems like a good sort of takeaway, I guess, overall. You know, your investment in the community obviously is an investment towards anti-racism, anti-violence, all of the things that, you know, kind of work to sometimes separate people from each other, mm-hmm. right? So that sort of concern for your neighbor through solidarity is a good way to kind of say that violence against one is a violence against all.
Right.
And that is absolutely the situation we are in on planet Earth. As sad as it is 50 years ago that we didn't have that idea, and I still don't think we all have that idea today, it's kind of part of the rolling cause for the campaign of Fridays for Future and the global climate strike. Any other things you wanted to mention? Other areas of the collection that you looked at that you got a benefit out of?
Yeah, I mean, I really just enjoyed looking at, well, reading through all the different articles that students would publish surrounding issues of ecology. And this didn't necessarily pertain to what was happening at UConn. It was just their sort of dialogue of, you know, what was happening around the globe. And I think that one really interesting thing from the that came out of the Free Press a little bit before that Earth Day, it was back in February of 1970, was I think it's still something that we're facing today, this idea that people who jump on the ecological bandwagon spin a lot of the movement as the damage that man does on his fellow man in terms of individual pollution, and kind of steers it away from the involvement of big corporations. And a lot of the sustainability acts that we have on UConn campus, I think they're definitely focused on individual actions. You know, we can recycle, we can, you know, swap clothes, recycle our sneakers, sort of things like that, eat locally, that kind of things, which is all great things that you can do. But I think from here, especially that issue we're still kind of facing is people kind of glossing over the destruction that an industry like any business or like a university, you know, the kind of larger scale damage that they can do versus like one individual person, and like really holding them accountable for their actions as a whole institution, as opposed to like this one person is not recycling, they're the cause of this entire chain of environmental destruction. And I just thought that was interesting, these narratives that keep repeating themselves.
And this is largely found in the student newspaper, The Free Press, is that
yes,
right?
Okay. Yes.
And did you find much in the Daily Campus regarding similar issues, ecology movement, anything like that?
Not entirely, no. The Daily Campus, they were really good on documenting what was happening in that original Earth Day. But I was sad to see that I personally couldn't find any information on student opinion or anything surrounding the environmental movement.
I know when we first sat down about this topic, we'd kind of struggled to think historically about some of the terms to look for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today we're talking about climate change, which I don't think they were talking about in the same way.
No.
Can you tell us just roughly like what some of the topics were, some of the terms that they used for the kind of adjacent environmental activism that you would think of historically?
Yeah, a lot of it was just focused on ecology specifically as a thing, and pollution was a very big buzzword, so to speak, for what was happening at the time. There were a lot of people concerned with things like DDT and how that was affecting people and how that was affecting the environment.
Earth Day, obviously, was
Earth Day, yes.
Big phrase.
Yes, for sure. Recycling. There was at Avery Point campus, I guess, an environmental education committee who was focused on preserving the wetlands because a lot of them were being filled for developmental purposes. But yeah, a lot of it was just focused on education surrounding these specific words like ecology, you know, pollution, that kind of stuff.
Right. The general awareness that we've kind of moved towards, and hopefully not, as you were kind of mentioning, kind of becomes the leverage for social shaming, which I think is kind of what that initial mm-hmm. Free Press statement was making about mm-hmm. kind of condemning each other for not doing enough versus the larger enterprise that really occurs in this kind of economic system.
Right.
So, Okay, well, again, you've been listening to Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. I was joined today with Adriana Chestnut, who is a UConn senior political science human rights double major who had just completed an internship at the Archives and Special Collections, working through historical materials regarding student activism and ecology. Adriana, thank you for being on the show, and thank you for being committed to your community around these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
All right, we will check everybody else next week. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can find out more about the UConn Archives and Special Collections at UConn Archives on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or listen online at whus.org. Our theme song is Dream in Cassio Tone by Arable Lands, graphic design by Melica Bloom. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.